faster, 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 and finally don't make a lot of sense. They just sort of wave at me and say, Ann, please slow down. Today I will be focusing the talk on men who matter and not talking as much about the people that matter or the children in those violent families, at least in terms of my presentation. However, I work with family members who are battered and have seen a lot of the children, so if you have questions during the discussion period, please feel free to ask those questions as well, although my formal presentation won't be covering that area. I'll be talking a little bit about domestic violence, the whole area, a little bit about what it is or what I see it is in my work. Then talking about the characteristics of men who are involved in domestic violence. And then thirdly, about treatment issues and working with these men. At some point, we'll also take a break. Connie says we have until 11:30. I don't think I can talk straight for that long, so we'll take a break. My comments are based on my experiences of the past 4 years. I've been working with the Veterans Hospital that time. My caseload is 90% male, and therefore have worked with a lot of men over that period of time who've involved in family violence. The project that I am co-director of has been in existence since February. So some of what I'll be talking about today is based on the domestic assault program. It's also based on a lot of my conversations with other clinicians who are working with men or working with the couples. I can say it's based on a lot of literature because there isn't a lot about the men right now. There's a considerable body of literature that has been developed around the women, but very little on the men, and even less on children who are in violent families. So I can't sort of give you a nice annotated bibliography to read or quote 20 resources that my data is based on. A lot of it will be clinical impressions and what we call educated guesses, but at least it's a place to start in developing programs for men. How did I get into it? Not willingly. What happened when my interest in working in domestic violence started 4 years ago, my first week at the hospital as a psychology intern. And my supervisor told me to take the next three cases that came through the door. Well, the next three cases, the first one that came through the door was a young man, 28-year-old man, who had attempted to kill his parents with an axe. The second case that came through the door was a 45-year-old man who had been living with his brother, and he had severely beaten his brother repeatedly over several years. The third case that came through the door was a 29-year-old young man who beat his wife every day for 3 years. I got a little paranoid at that and thought that my supervisor had set me up. And I said, you know, what's going on? What's happening? You know, why are all these violent people? I think because I did not know a lot about domestic violence, so in that early stages of my working in the area, I tended to see family violence as individual pathology. It was something out of kilter with that individual person that created a situation where he was violent in the family. In other words, he was crazy. And that's the way I tended to look at it. You know, you had to be crazy to be beating someone up every day. You had to be crazy to be, you know, beating up your brother, someone that you were financially dependent upon. And so that's, you know, the way I looked at it. And it's only been as I've had more experience in working with the men and started to do some homework, started doing some of the reading in the area, especially some of Murray Strauss's work and domestic violence, that I started to realize that what we are dealing with is not individual pathology. We're dealing with a social problem. And there are a lot of cultural norms, cultural myths that support and facilitate violence within the family, and that really encourage the men to be violent. So it's not that they're crazy, but that they act out the norms that is in the society as a whole. And I'll talk more about that in terms of how to approach them and treat them. Okay, so I started 4 years ago without any framework at all, without any way of conceptualizing what I was dealing with, except that the person was crazy. Now, where I began, or the framework I use, is a behavioral work. I start first with the violent behavior, sort of what is it? When I say a man is involved in battering, what am I saying that he's doing? And I sort of lump, and other clinicians working in the area, sort of lump the behavior into four groups. First is the physical assault, and that can come in lots of ways. There's spitting, kicking, shoving, throwing down stairs, punching, throwing acid in the face, pushing people into boiling water, using weapons. All of that physical behavior that we consider violence, that we consider assault against another person, is that category. Then there's what we call psychological battering. And this is a lot of verbal behavior. And when I say psychological battering, I mean that the person doesn't actually physically touch the other person. There isn't a physical assault, while there may be a lot of threat of a physical assault. But when I say psychological battering, I just don't mean yelling and screaming at the person and calling a spouse, you know, a whore, or calling her this or that. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the kinds of verbal battering that goes on that we as psychologists label brainwashing. It's waking the abused person up in the middle of the night and giving her a 3-hour lecture on something. I see a veteran population, so they're often lecture their spouses about the VA system, or how bad the government was, or what this person did. And it will go on and on and on and on. And it's not just sort of waking her up and blowing up once. It is brainwashing. It's depriving the person of sleep. Another example of psychological battery that Lenore Walker talked about is that she had one couple that she worked with where the woman said that the most severe case of battering that she experienced, and she had been badly beaten several times, was a time when he forced her to get down on her hands and knees and bark like a dog. He did not actually physically assault her at that point. There was a threat of that. But that was a kind of battering, a kind of humiliation. That we often see goes along with the physical battering. So the person may not always be physically beaten, but is battered. Another category is physical, but I separate it out just because it gets confusing for people. And that's, for some men involved in battering relationships, there's a lot of sexual violence. And it's true that if that man was married to the woman, then the legal system doesn't see it as rape, but that is going on. We're here for sexual activity and include physical violence with it. Women in talking with me have been forced to do sexual activity with a gun pointed at their head. And with him haranguing her that she's not aroused, it's very difficult to be aroused when it's pointed on a gun at her. There's that kind of sexual violence that also goes on in some of the battered relationships. The fourth category is destruction of property or pets, where the assaults are not necessarily directed at the abused person, but a lot of property is damaged. Dishes, cars, windows, walls, doors. If you go into homes, and I don't know how many of you are caseworkers and have the opportunity to actually visit some of the homes, you look around, the homes are often in pretty bad shape. And it's not because the people of Dakota are poor, but it's because of all the violence that has occurred within that home. There are scars and examples of that violence around. Okay, all four categories, the sexual violence, the physical violence, the destruction of property, and the psychological battering, have some common characteristics or qualities. The purpose of all of them is to dominate someone. The impact of breaking a set of dishes on the person who's watching is just as powerful as slaying her in the face. It's the same kind of fear starts up. It's usually coercive, and it's usually repeated. Very rarely, in the men that I work with, do I see, like, for example, the destruction of property aimed at no one. No one's around. If he goes and he beats down the door. He beats down the door when a family member's there that he's directing the attack on. So it's coercive, it's repeated, and the purpose of it is to dominate or control the person. All of those four categories also violate the rights of other people. They violate the person's privacy, their sense of autonomy, their sense of being able to say yes or no. Okay? That's the framework or the reference points that I use in starting to work with them. Exactly what is he doing? Does he do physically assault her, sexually assault her, destruction of property, psychologically battered? Very rarely do I find psychological battering without one of the other categories. I don't work with people who simply psychologically batter someone. Now, maybe I work with very selective people. The ones that come to me for treatment, I have already gotten into one of the other areas of destroying the property or the person's body or essentially being violent. But I usually don't see just psychological rather. My perspective and the person who's co-director with me, domestic violence we see as learned behavior. We do not see it as genetic. It has nothing to do with it has something to do with being masculine in our culture, but it has nothing to do with male genes. And doesn't usually have any physiological base. There are some exceptions. There are certain kinds of brain lesions, tumors, certain kinds of brain damage where the person will be assaulted. But that is very rare. We see a small percentage of that because we are a hospital setting, but that's not as common as we think. You can ask now, and if I want you to hold it, I'll just say hold it.
Yeah, you said repetitive, and I was wondering what the range was. Once a day?
Range?
We cut it off, like once every 6 weeks or once a year. I mean, if someone battered once a year, would that be considered?
Okay. I take one incident as battering as serious and as reason for treatment. So this is the one incident. Okay, the reason why I do that is I had one man that I worked with that was violent twice, once in his first marriage and once in his second marriage. He never physically touched her in any other time. The first wife he killed, he beat to death. The second wife he shot. And those were his only battering incidents. And so I take one incident very seriously. Also, if you look at it from a treatment angle, it's easier to work with a person who's been involved in one incident than a person who's been involved in. So I think it's important for us as helpers, or whatever we want to call ourselves, to take one incident seriously. Okay. My perspective is that it is learned. And we learn it every place. We learn it primarily in our families. And I'll talk some more. Men who are batterers, usually were battered as children, or witnessed a lot of abuse as children. In other words, their father battered their mother, if not him directly. think the whole, one of the strongest messages that we learn in our families, and women learn it too, is that we can hit someone they love for their own good. You know, when I got slapped in my bottom for doing something at home, my father always, and my mother always told me it was my own good. You know, I was going to be a better person because I got slapped. And they only were doing it because they loved me. They really cared. And I learned that. And the men that I work with also had that experience. And most of us have had that experience. It doesn't mean that we'll all become matters, but that's a strong norm in our culture that we can hit because we love someone for that person's own good. And that keeps coming back to me. Hearing that in their own words. But that's what they're doing. They're hitting her because they really care about her for her own good. The other places that we learn, that the men learn to do violent, is in the culture as a whole. You know, we are a pretty violent society. We see it a lot in our heroes, whether it's Kojak on TV or Starsky and Hutch, or whether it's Roadrunner. You ever watch the Roadrunner cartoons? The coyote gets it 13 times in the first 5 minutes. We learn that the way to solve problems, to solve conflict, is to be aggressive, to be violent. Nations do it. They go to war. You know, any problems? Let's be violent. There's also a lot of sort of cultural norms, and I don't want to spend a lot of time, just sort of want to give a hint of it, about males being violent or being dominant or controlling in their families. You know, there is an accepted norm in our culture that men are to be head of the household. You know, they are to provide discipline not only for the children but also their spouses. There's the cultural norm that the family is safer. That the home is a man's castle, and that he can do what he wants within the confines of his home. I think some of those sort of norms is why it's been difficult for people to move in this area and to intervene, because there's a tendency on the part of police officers and social workers, psychologists, psychiatrists, to say, well, that's a family matter. That, you know, I'm not going to get involved in that. If he's beating up on his neighbor, then we'd be perfectly willing to get involved. But when it's a family member, we're much more reluctant because of that norm that the man's house is happening.
And there's a lot of that belief that if you want to get involved with the family, you're going to get involved and you're going to start it.
My dad's a cop, and growing up, I've heard about domestic disputes on the cop. He's terrified of them. The one thing cops, he hated to go out on family arguments, because he wasn't sure he was going to get hit. And so I think for some of us as interveners, it's that fear.